This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location today. Our poet is Laura Oram, and here she is with an opening poem.
So, why write at all? Everything's been said before. The fragility of nature, the brevity of life, the heavy footprint of man across the landscape of history, by souls more eloquent than I am. But I wanted to tell you how the blue sky arcs above the hill of Latimer's farm, and the sun sets behind the corn, how the Dharmic cows, swaying as if gimbaled, taste the back of your hand with the tips of their tongues, and sometimes let you stroke their black noses like wet leather with just one finger.
That is the voice of Laura Oram. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and she knows what she's talking about because she owns and runs a farm in addition to writing poetry, in addition to teaching at Goucher College. And so did you get inspiration from that poem, from actual noses?
Absolutely. My neighbors down the street run a dairy farm, and they're very, very tolerant of the city girl coming down the road and gushing over their cows. And so it was real. They were real cows in a real farm.
Yeah, but you're not a city girl anymore. What have you got? What kind of critters have you got living with you?
Well, we have 2 sheep, 1 horse, 6 cats, and 4 dogs. And we'd like to get more sheep and some goats and some alpacas once we get the fence up.
And who wouldn't? I mean, really. Is there a reason for this?
Well, first of all, there's the tawdry economic reason. You get a terrific tax break for having any kind of agricultural venture going on up in Pennsylvania. But also, for me, I've always wanted to be surrounded by animals, and I get a lot from being with my animals. And, you know, they kind of keep me centered and focused.
Do you shear your own sheep?
No, I thought I was going to try to do that, and I made a very brief attempt, and then I called Nate, the sheep shearer who comes in the spring, and he does it in about, a 30th of the time it would take me, and it's quite an adventure, and it's fun, and it's entertaining, so it's worth it.
But how do the sheep like it?
They love it, because by that time they're really hot.
Laura Oram, we're talking to her on location. She was born in New York and raised in Maryland. She now lives in Red Lion, Pennsylvania. It sounds like a country song. On a small farm, she's married, has 2 grown sons, and she has her Master of Fine Arts from Bennington. She's a writer, and she's a graduate of their writing seminars. So let's hear one more poem.
Okay. I'll do another farm poem. August Pastoral. The sheep does not mind much, not even the necessary attention to his wounds. Ragged bite marks on his neck from an old dog ricocheted back to wildness by the archaic scent of prey. The sheep and his brother are Zen masters of the barnyard, accepting rain and grass and first aid with the same slow breath and placid stare. They swallow the world whole in a way we have forgotten, who cannot see a rainbow arc across a summer sky without unprisming it into white light, into something we think we understand.
What is the major thing you have learned from being with creatures that are not human?
I think it sort of goes back to that old serenity prayer about accepting what you can't change and changing what you can. The animals don't get tied up in knots about little stuff. They pretty much, you know, are about food and warmth and your good company sometimes, especially when you've got food. And they bring you back to earth, or at least they bring me back to earth when I'm kind of bothered by the tough and annoying things of life.
Laura Oram, we're talking to her. Now, you have been writing poetry, you've been reading poetry, you've been teaching poetry, and you must have come away from that with one central truth. If you just had to, off the top of your head, just the first thing that pops off, what do you think is the largest truth you have in your head right now about that?
I think, going back to that old essay that writers often talk about, poetry does matter. Dana Gioia's essay about poetry, Can Poetry Matter?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. All we are is you know, the noise we can make or the moment we can freeze here on Earth. And I think that it's a way of reminding ourselves of our humanity and a way to connect with other people. So for me, it's always been that sort of moment of connection that comes across physical distance and temporal distance. And I think of Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry when he's saying, you know, I'm thinking of you right now, 100 years hence or even more, you know, I'm thinking of you and we're connected. And for me, that I think is the biggest thing that poetry brings to me.
That is such a great answer, really. I couldn't even think of what you might come up with because it's such a huge question. But is that something that you found in sort of a path of self-discovery, or is it something that Bennington provoked in you? How do you come across that hunger to be connected to the past and the present?
Well, I think everybody has got that hunger to be connected because we're certainly alone in our own skins. But to name it, I mean, I grew up in a household where poetry was read, and my father was a great lover of poetry. And so I think it was there, but it was unnamed. We liked it. We enjoyed it. Going through the writing seminars and being with other people who felt the same way and who could expose me to other poems and poets that I might not come across on my own just reinforced it and gave me the means to articulate it, I think.
So it's really an opening of doors when you go to a writing seminar. I mean, they're really not imparting measurable information, right?
Well, there's that too, because you learn, you know, the basic nuts and bolts of prosody too. Mm-hmm. But there is the other thing that you're with a group of people who care about the same stuff you do, who say that it does matter and that we're doing important work.
And how alone we are in the dark after the poem is gone. Here's Laura Oram with another poem.
Okay. This is an older poem about when I had a much smaller garden than I have now. The Forgiveness of Hummingbirds. A drought-strangled summer, too hot, too dry to worry about the garden, water restricted by law. The plants wither and burn, and I do nothing. No heart to feed the birds. The hummingbird nectar goes sour, the feeder spout turning black and flaky with mold. Even the yellow jackets abandon it. But one August morning, late summer guilt finally moves me. In pre-dawn murk, I turn an illicit hose on the whole yard and dismantle the feeder, scrub and scour and boil water and sugar for fresh nectar, even though I know the hummingbirds have long since moved on. The flowers hang their shriveled, sodden heads as if praying for my undependable soul. The morning turns brighter and hotter while I stand barefoot in the damp grass, thinking about responsibility and $100 fines. Ordinary noises rise on the humid air, cars revving, dogs barking, the slap of newspaper on pavement. Then, unbelievably, out of nowhere, there he is, a male ruby throat slurping the spillage around the feeder's sticky cork, dipping again and again into its dripping spout. He hasn't read the books that say hummingbirds are unforgiving, won't return to feeders gone spoiled or empty. His wings blur an iridescent green as he drinks and drinks, hovering and backing and probing with his long, elegant beak, his garnet red throat quivering with each swallow. A little like forgiveness to me, watching in my pajamas, the small blessing that comes when you aren't looking, the improbable gift you don't deserve.
That's wonderful. I think that the Airstream has just taken them away. I think we haven't seen our hummingbird in 2 days. Have you?
No, I think they're gone. Mm-hmm. They're off to warmer climes for the winter.
Here's who she is. She is a writing fellow at Goucher College in Baltimore. She taught at Harford Community College in Bel Air, Maryland. Villa Julie, is it Villa Julie?
Villa Julie College.
In Stevenson, Maryland. And she taught online for a Swedish university. What was that?
That was a creative writing course. It was done in English. I don't speak Swedish. But it was a creative writing course for a group of adult students. And it was a lot of fun.
She's been an editor for Imagine, which was the monthly magazine of Johns Hopkins University Center for Talented Youth, and she is a book review editor for the Montserrat Review. I want to talk about your work in cyber, because you do reach millions of people. You have a blog on best American poetry. First of all, how did that come about?
I was asked to do a week of blogging. Stacey Harwood and David Lehman are the ones who run the blog. David Lehman is the series editor for the Best American Poetry. And they invited me to just blog for a week as a guest. And I got a very nice response to that. And then they invited me to become a regular weekly blogger for them. So that was how that happened.
It is fabulous. That is the most fabulous thing. Because you are not... You don't designate a tiny little part of poetry and talk about that. You actually approach it like a cultural critic, and you weave in the meanings of words in a larger context, sometimes of pop culture, sometimes of high culture. How do you get an idea, and how does that cook inside of you?
Well, I think I have, I'm one of these people who I'm kind of an autodidact, so I'm interested in a lot of different things. And anybody who writes poetry knows that anything can spark it. So, and I've also got the wonderful freedom, because I'm allowed to write about anything except for personal attacks or partisan election year politics, which can be a little difficult this year. But I behave myself. But other than that, it's pretty much an open book.
Well, describe the latest one you just have done, where you include audio and video clips, which take a certain amount of expertise that for people under 80, that you gotta have it. And the one that I love the best, I always love the last one best, but this is about Helen Keller.
Mm-hmm.
And you make a larger argument about what words mean. Would you just tell us, unravel that little blog for a moment?
Sure. I approached it looking at, I started thinking of coded language. I'm really interested. I love the blues, particularly the old blues ladies of the 1920s. And a lot of blues music and the lyrics, a lot of blues lyrics are written in this coded language. Things usually having to do with sex. But I started thinking of that and about how all of language is a code.
I used to think a jelly roll was really something you got at a bakery. Until I learned the blues.
And that, it's a lot of fun to listen to. And I often imagine what it must have been like to be somebody who was in the know back in those more innocent days, listening with somebody who wasn't in the know, and just thinking she was actually singing about going to the bakery. But I started thinking about language as a whole as being code, and how words have many, many different meanings. And as poets, we work on that level. We work with metaphor. That means, there's the denotative definition of words, and then there's the connotative, which is one of my lessons I teach in school, so it's coming, my teacher side's coming out. And I've also been really interested in the story of Anne Sullivan and Helen Keller. Much beyond the Hollywood version of it, it's even a more wonderful story than the wonderful movie that was made with Anne Bancroft and Patty Duke. But how do we learn what language is, and then how do we use it? And I sort of jumped off on, we hear a lot of, particularly now in political ads, people say one thing, but they're inferring something else. So I explored that a little bit, how language works on, I said lurks, but that could work too. Dr. Freud, thank you. But works on many levels, and that sometimes I don't think we are always aware of those different levels, and perhaps we need to pay closer attention.
And just briefly, what was the scene you showed on video?
Oh, it was the famous scene of Helen suddenly at the water pump realizing that the finger movements, the letters that Annie has been spelling into her hand means the thing of water. And that very dramatic moment where it's suddenly the light comes on.
And you in that article say, no ideas, but in things, which is a William Carlos Williams quote, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was Laura Oram, and now she's going to read you a poem.
Okay. This is one that kind of speaks to the idea of, like, being interested in everything, that freedom to go and be use anything as grist for the mill. And this is about volcanoes, which I've never seen, but I want to one day. Volcanology. Mm-hmm. In the drawings of children, they stand conical, topped with snow, alone. Postcards from Mount Fuji, but with a fountain of fire, red as a million suns, frothing over the crater's edge. A dinosaur or two roam the slopes, rivulets of lava licking at their stolid ankles, too clumsy to get away. Grown, we fear a geological id that springs its subterranean chaos on the blasphemer, the arrogant, the curious, the fool. We give them names like offerings, Vesuvius, Kilauea, Pinatubo. Hmm. We haunt their vivid eyes with Geiger counters and video cameras, tap gas, measure vent and bulge, and pray to their spirits as if that will appease their pyroclastic fury. We say they sleep, but still they cast up hoodoos, the spun glass of Pele's hair, the green glass of Pele's tears. The metaphor of rock and magma echoes within blood and muscle, both alive, both waiting for the corresponding pressure of heart and stone.
This is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Laura's work has been in many magazines, including The Writer's Chronicle, Nimrod, Heart, which is Human Equity Through Art, Word Rights, Poets Against the War website, and many other journals. Poets Against the War. Is it fair to say you are a social activist?
In my non-writing life, I'm not as active as I would like to be. I think I'm a socially conscious person, socially aware. Oftentimes, it comes out in the poems. I wish I was more energetic and more able to go and, you know, stand on the White House steps and do those kind of marches and things.
You have very strong opinions, and you make those known, I think, very well and very directly. And I would almost call you a political poet. Would that scare you?
It wouldn't scare me. I tend to go with Carolyn Forché talks about, you know, we tend to group poems as personal poems or political poems, mm-hmm. but she recommends or advocates for another term, the social, where they kind of intersect. Because, you know, poets don't live in ivory towers alone, not writing beautiful words in a vacuum. We are part of our society, our culture. So I get inspired by what, or motivated, inspired is probably not the right word, but motivated by things I see in the on the political sphere, in the social sphere, just as much as I get motivated by my sheep.
But isn't all poetry political just by virtue of the anarchy of setting words on edge?
I think you could make that argument. Certainly, there's the idea that it glorifies and advocates the individual vision, the power of the individual in a world that often tries to stifle that, tries to destroy that. I think of the poet Miklos Radnaté, who was a Hungarian poet who was killed on a death march, a forced death march at the end of World War II, and his work was found. He had somehow secreted a notebook on his march and a pencil and wrote poems. Some of them, we would probably classify them as political. Some of them were just about missing his wife. But on this march, and his just the act of writing poetry, I think you could advocate as the political act, because certainly the Nazis were not just trying to kill him. They were trying to obliterate his existence and the act of to say he never existed. And the poem remains and says, yes, I do. Yes, I did.
The poem remains. That's Laura Oram, and here she is.
All right. I'd like to read, if it's okay, a kind of a political poem. This is a recent poem from an exercise that some poet friends of mine and I were working with of giving each of us a list of words that we had to write a poem a month and using the words or as many of them as we felt appropriate. So I didn't start out to write a political poem, but the words sort of opened the door for me. Letter from Guantanamo. Seasons don't matter except for the discomfort they bring. June is just hotter. The Caribbean thuds against Cuba, steaming like soup, saltier than our tears, if anyone cried here. Whether we bear it or not, the pain continues. The interrogator takes his work as seriously as Michelangelo considers the perfect pink of God's fingertips. Once I ate sweet dates and dreamed of doing something important. Now the sun, that holy eye, stares down on the sea and sand, strikes us blind.
Do you remember any of the words that were in the list? Just maybe a couple?
Well, I remember pink was in the list. And I thought, how am I going to work pink in there? I don't remember, actually, at this point.
Do you think you got all 10 in?
Close.
Yeah.
The bear. Bear was in there, too. The word bear.
Oh, that's right. Pink and bear.
Yes.
Right. Laura Oram, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location, and we're glad. And she is a visual artist, as well as a word maker. Now, I've seen your creations, and they are mind-blowing, beautiful, intricate, sparkly, fairy dust, pretty. And surely there's a different part of your head that approaches a relic or an artifact that you want to create rather than an amorphous thing such as words. Mm-hmm. So what is the difference? What happens to you when you want to use your hands?
I think, and this is just for me, I don't know how other people who work in the visual arts feel. For me, I work visually more intuitively because basically I'm not trained and I don't know what I'm doing. So I don't make conscious design decisions and things like that. So it's much more, the approach is much more sort of letting it happen, much more spontaneous. But I think that there's a lot of similarity between working in the visuals and working with poetry, because you work with the image in poetry. You are working to create this visual, albeit mental, image. So I think that there is more of a connection. Interestingly, I started doing the visual stuff during a period when I was not writing at all. So it sort of came out in a different direction without pressure, because not being trained, not being a visual calling myself a visual artist at the time, it didn't matter if it was awful. there was no pressure. It was just fun. So it was a real lifesaver for me. I think it sort of allowed that part of that creative part, that poet part that wasn't able to come out through words during that time, to come out in a different way.
She's strong, she's pretty, she's smart, she's the Rachel Maddow of poetry. And here she is with a poem.
I'd like to actually read this poem. It's about my father, who was, like many of his most of his generation, he was in the service during World War II. And he was a sailor, and he worked in salvage and rescue in the South Atlantic. So if ships were torpedoed, his ship was the one who went to save the men or to tow what was left of the ship back to dock so they could either salvage it or junk the metal and reuse it. Salvage and Rescue. And the epigraph is by Tim O'Brien. You can tell a true war story by its absolute and uncompromising allegiance to obscenity and evil. In my father's stories, the most terrible thing was the death of Lady, a fluffy white dog so small she could fit in the pocket of a sailor's peacoat, the ship's mascot washed overboard in a storm. When we found her drowned the next day, we gave her a burial at sea. We even gave her a 21-gun salute. In my father's stories, the Caribbean was a blue jewel set against the green jewels of Haiti, Cuba, Trinidad. The Andrews sisters sang of rum and Coca-Cola. Dolphins leapt at the tumble home. And off the coast of Venezuela, magic. 1,000 parrots just appeared one morning perched in the rigging. As the sailors drank their coffee, the birds arced a movable rainbow across the brightening sky. God, it was beautiful. In my father's stories, adventure was dodging the skipper's monkey. He'd steal your glasses right off your nose and chatter at you from the top of the crow's nest just out of reach. Hours later, you'd find your glasses somewhere he'd dropped them. If you were lucky, no one had stepped on them. In my father's stories, No one ever wept with loneliness when no letter came from home. No one imagined their children growing up as strangers. No one crouched under the shadow of the big guns on the bow, gibbering a panicked prayer that the shell hit anyone else but him. No one begged, "Let me live, let me live." No one killed an enemy. No enemies to be seen in my father's stories. And in my father's stories, no one ever died. No ship sank. No men swam in desperate slow motion away from the flaming hulk, suction pulling irresistibly at their heels. No pleading survivors machine-gunned in their life rafts. No U-boats dodging depth charges to spit evil-eyed torpedoes at Allied convoys. In his stories, my father never pulled over the ship's rail a half-drowned man, burned black with gasoline, puking salt water and blood and fuel across the steel-plated deck. My father never hauled a dead man from the ocean, bloated from floating days and days in the tropical sun, never cursed as the man burst his stinking insides onto the fantail. He never checked a dog tag, thumbed a wallet, compared the swollen tongue, the jutting bones, the eye holes like black marbles with a sodden ID card or dissolving snapshot, never wrote a letter to a friend's widow. And in my father's stories, he never trembled sleepless in his bunk, waiting for the blare of general quarters, the whistle of a bomb dropped from 1,000 feet up, or just the flash and blast, then the cold, terrible sea.
Oh, Laura, that is, I think, your best poem, because of the inverse reality. You know, how much more powerful than approaching it full front, you know, by coming in it from the back. That is truly, he never, in history, he never killed. He never killed. Mm-hmm. And what else do you say? No one ever died.
Yep.
No one ever died. What a wonderful story. Laura teaches also, what is the biggest thing we have to confront in our children going to college? What do we have to do with them?
Oh, goodness. Well, As somebody, I teach freshman writing, so I'm not teaching poetry per se, although I sneak it in every chance I get. But I think what I find is that a lot of young people have not had the opportunity, have not been exposed to poetry, except, you know, in 10th grade English classes where they're so worried what they're going to be asked on the test. What does this symbolize? I wrote to a friend not too long ago in an email. We were talking about William Carlos Williams' Red Wheelbarrow, this poor little poem that has been beaten over its head or beaten, has been used to beat students over their heads. And, you know, so that they never want to look at red wheelbarrows, white chickens, or poems again. And so that for me is I think my first job a lot of times is to open them up to say that this isn't about making you feel stupid or whether it's right on the test. It's about to go back to what we were saying before, making a connection between human beings.
Let us have a final poem.
Okay. This one was my poem in response to the September 11th attacks. And the thing that I remember is what a beautiful day it was. It was an incredibly beautiful, beautiful day and a beautiful evening that night. In September, the stars hang alone in the late summer sky, empty for the first time in 100 years. So still, not even the barest breath of wind ruffles the dog's fur. Once upon a time, the growl of an airplane called the whole town into the street, pointing and marveling at the wonderful new machine. We are hunkered down, waiting, but the dog still needs her walk. In the clear, archaic night, we can see light years beyond each celestial body. Didn't Einstein say the universe curves back to its beginning? Maybe if we look deep enough, we will see ourselves looking deep at ourselves. Or maybe vision just dissolves in the unknowable dark. Maybe all we see is nighttime after all. In the whirling universe, the world hasn't moved an inch. The dog pokes her snout into the grass, wags her tail, moves on. There's nothing new here she can smell. Even the stars know that. No need to look up and tell them so.
That's the voice of Laura Oram.
For bestamericanpoetry.com, All you have to do is Google that, bestamericanpoetry.com, and then you will get to the blog and you'll be able to find Laura Oram's column. This is Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem. We'll be right back. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today we're on location with Ann Caston, who's just here from Alaska, and she's going to tell you all about it, and she's going to start by reading a poem. Here's Ann.
A friend urges me to write in praise of the natural world. Exalt the reeds and praise the river all you want. Such exaltation changes nothing, not the river drifting by indifferently, not the reeds bowing to water and wind, not the boy who drowned here early May. Enough about death, you say, enough. I know, there's little music in such singing. Or if there is, it's the music of totems coming finally into the craftsman's hands, that splintering at the ends of things. Below, I say, look there below, where the god in the shadows rose. After all, by my hand, no one dies who is not dead already. And some things show us who we are. I am wedded to the telling.
That's Ann Caston. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Ann Caston is core faculty of the MFA program in writing at the University of Alaska, Anchorage, where she is an associate professor of poetry. But she's ours right now, and she's moved to Pennsylvania. But I think you're going to still have something to do with Alaska, right?
Yes, I'll still be teaching in the MFA program. We've just moved to a low residency format, so we only have to be there in the students in the summertime for the intensive residency periods.
How long were you there, and what did you do?
I was at the University of Alaska for 9 years, first in Fairbanks, then in Anchorage, and taught in both cases in the MFA program in creative writing.
The poem that we have just heard is from a new manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
How do you characterize that work?
The new book will probably be called The Empress of Longing, and I'm really giving it all up in this one. No holds barred. It's a sort of, I think of it as a poetic homecoming.
What is a poetic homecoming? Well, I thought you came home a long time ago. I mean, you have courage. You take risks. What can this book possibly do?
It really focuses on my life as a Southern woman, something I've avoided for a very long time.
We just want you to know that her 1996 book won the New York University Press Prize for Poetry. That was from NYU, and it was called Flying Out with the Wounded. That was her first collection. She's been going gangbusters, and she's here to tell you about it. So let's have another poem.
Okay. This one is called Deer Season, and it's comes from a time when I was a fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in a strange place where I didn't know anybody. So I was the one at the edges of everything. So this is a poem called Deer Season. In Shoney's this morning at a center table, 5 men in flannel and bright orange vests, speaking loudly of hunting and guns, of the buck they hope to bring down, the knife, the gutting, the rack of antlers. Mm-hmm. When a boy in the next booth drops his jacket, his mother fusses, "Jacob, don't throw your coat on the floor." The men chuckle. One winks and leans over to say to her, "A typical boy, ma'am." Mm-hmm. She jerks back as if slapped, then stammers, "Not quite." Something stricken in her voice shakes her boy, who turns face forward toward the man who can see now the puckered socket where an eye and cheekbone used to be. The boy is watching his mother's flushed face. She is watching the man's. If it isn't cruelty how she lets that man go on sitting there, ash-faced, staring after the boy, who has turned back already to his green toy soldiers and the war he is making with them? Well, it isn't kindness either. Across the room, sounds lift. A cough, clacking spoons, the clatter of cups, a glass shattering. The woman retrieves the dropped coat. The men turn back to their plates, to what's left of their coffee and eggs, to the frosty morning beyond the window. Anything but that face. One by one, each man shoves a dollar bill under the rim of a plate. One by one, each gets up, takes a coat, goes out. They gather again on the sidewalk beyond the ice-pocked window. They shake their heads and shove their fists deep into pockets. They leave for the cold fields. They don't look back. The boy with his one blue eye watches them go.
Mm-hmm. That is the voice of Anne Caston. Once you hear her work, you will be haunted by her work. She sounds like no one else. She's a lyric poet, but she's a narrative poet. What do you think a narrative poet is?
In my case, I think it's someone who takes the music of the lyric poem, the sounds of lyric, the implications and not the overt statements, but then puts them in an order where an implied narrative begins to unfold.
I've never heard anything so well put in all my life, but that is exactly what you do because you're all about sound and story.
Yeah.
And one, I can't tell where one begins and the other does end, but you are a storyteller. So what do you feel about your work in the tradition of great American storytellers?
Well, great American storytellers, I don't know.
But your stories are of the heart.
Right.
But they are stories.
Right, they are stories. I think that comes out of a natural proclivity of people in America to be tuned to a story. We learn this from childhood. Our best memories are of being read to or hearing stories from our elders. And so we listen to stories. We understand how they string together. And so narration in a poem, whether overt or implied, is something that people can listen to. They don't have to follow along on the page to get anything.
Where do your words come from?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't a clue.
That's another poem.
Okay. This one is also from The Empress of Longing, the new book, and it's called Portrait of the Artist as a Southern Woman. Some had the decency to just lie down when the tanks roll over them, not her. For her, housework is the weapon of choice. For every quarrel she cannot win, spotless countertops, a pantry ordered, labels facing front. Her porch is rife with potted red geraniums, gaudy as girlhood dreams, though the spiders of necessity go on toiling in the eaves. The barn owl descends the long glide slope of his hunger, and the field mice scurry away in terror. Each time now the river overruns its banks and comes to her stoop, carrying off a new litter of kittens, she reminds herself the river is just being true to itself. No blame in that is there, to love a thing for what it is, all riddle and disaster. And every time some famous critic says, "You cannot write about the dead," she puts them there, inside the poem, out of malice and pure spite. She knows her voice offends that man, but he drifts by with such indifference she's forced to use it anyway. Oh, but she would love to build a house where the moon could dally all night with the lanterns and candlesticks, a place where new sun would arrive each morning despite the dark top knot of night, a place where there'd be more to tell one day of who she was than just the mud suck and the corpse she'd leave behind and the brittle blue flag of her apron. That house would be a place where all the lost and dead could rest a while, like purgatory, no funeral necessary, and they could arrive there late as long-lost luggage coming to the stoop. The flawed incandescence of her failures would lead them there, and they would be grateful for clean sheets to lie in, lace-edged pillow slips, a jar of milk at breakfast, wildflowers in a cracked blue cup on the kitchen sill. How does she bear it as she does, day in, day out, the frayed pink hem of her heart and those who tug at it?
That is the voice of Anne Caston, and you will not forget that in a hurry. She's visiting, finally from Alaska, and I hope forever, residing in Pennsylvania with her husband and her cat. Talk to us, Anne, about point of view and how that is manifested in that poem.
Well, as always, I am probably first and foremost a Southern woman because that's the circumstances of my birth and childhood and upbringing. But I'm also a child of literature. So to think of myself as an artist puts me in one camp, and then a Southern woman puts me in another. They're disparate things. So I'm trying to marry them together in the poem, because they are married in me. I'm the border between the different countries.
This is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and that is Anne Caston, and she's going to read you another poem.
This is a little tiny poem. This summer, one of our guest faculty at La Residency introduced us all to the ghazal, which is an ancient Persian form of writing. And I thought to myself when he did this exercise, I am not going to write in form. I did that for 20-something years. I'm abandoning it. But he said the ghazal is essentially a little lament. And I thought, oh, I can do that. So here was mine. And it had to be something true to what we felt like we were going through as writers. So here's my little ghazal. Now all the lost and ended things return. The sad and badly tended things. The bitten thread unspooling spool of time. The tipped to empty almost gone upended things. Mm-hmm. And I am gathering them to me, these lost, recalled, and recollected, re-befriended things, a blackened penny, half shoestring, one shattered cup, that mended thing, almost back to self again, like you, old dreamer, badly broken, almost splendid thing.
And for those of you who thought it was ghazal, tell the world how you spell
ghazal. Yeah, ghazal.
And that's the right way to pronounce it. Say it again.
Well, that's how Shahid, who is sort of the father of the ghazal in this country, pronounced it.
You'll try anything, won't you?
I will.
At least we know about you.
I have to resist it first, though.
That's part of your rebellious spirit.
It is.
And then you master it. We must say that. Then you master it. And you did get your MFA from Warren Wilson College.
I did.
And your undergraduate degree?
From St. Mary's College of Southern Maryland.
And at some time you taught there, I think, as well.
As an adjunct faculty, I did.
Yeah. What do you find is different about the students in Alaska from those in America? How do they approach poetry different? I mean, their whole circumstance is so wholly different from the Maine states. Do you find that the sensibility is?
I do. I find that our students come to us in the MFA program very well read to start with, because they've generally studied elsewhere. So they've studied in sort of middle America at the formal university level, most of them. But they come to the edge of the literary world and sort of fall off of it in Alaska, because they're looking to be true, to be genuine, to have the experience of writing outside that literary center. And that's a very frightening thing for, especially for poets who, you know, feel so marginalized anyway. So they come there to test themselves, to be alone and write. And I find them remarkable students.
You mean the people come to Alaska who do not live there? I mean, people come to study from other parts? I thought you just taught university students from Alaska.
I did until this past year when we changed our format. The ones who came to the residency program actually did move to Alaska. In Fairbanks, our graduate students lived in outlying cabins with outhouses. You know, they had heat, but that was about all they had. And so they really were testing themselves, I think, as writers.
More than any other writer, I think you've mastered the long form. Mm-hmm. And I always told you just knew too many words. There's something the matter here. You make them up or something. But you can make a lot out of very little, and it is magnificent. Mm-hmm. What does it take for the long haul? What is different about that energy, the dispatching of energy? You can write a 3-page poem that has me sitting on the edge of my seat at the last line, and I never lose the tension. How does that happen in you?
I think it is my proclivity to just be narrative at some level. But I didn't start that way. I started writing very tiny lyric poems that end with that powerful sort of punch at the end. But and they'll hit a listening audience fairly strongly, as you would hope they would. But I felt oftentimes that I didn't really get the poem in that way. So I began to trust, to accept the line that came after what I thought was the last line.
Oh. And then again.
And again, and again, and again.
This is Ann Cast, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is the poet and the poem On Location. Here she is.
Okay. A friend of mine recently came up with this hypothesis that we have an actual physical place where we're born and raised that stays with us no matter how far we try to run away from it. But he says, as writers, we also have an imaginary place that we think of as home, and we're always circling that. And for me, I find it's a combination of the two. So while I was still in Alaska, I wrote this poem, and I'll just read it. I think you'll get a sense of it. When God is done with me and you is the title. Evenings lately, just at dusk, if I sit alone, making no sound, it comes to me again, home. That place which long ago forsook me eases forward, timid as a schoolgirl, buttercups in its fists. That place where ditches bruise with thistle and all the fallen brick-red chimneys remember me by another name. That place where at the meadow's edge gilt haystacks blaze, and over the lake in which a red sun sinks, two loons cry out. There where the summer sunset sky becomes a splendor before which all of Egypt would bow gladly down, as would I, just to kiss the hem of it. Everything in that place knows how to bear in glory the weight of God's silence. There, if I want without a word, I can lie all night in the fields, let the rain come down or the stars, no matter. When God is done with me and you are also done with suffering, I will empty my pockets of pebbles and twine. I will wave farewell to the ghosts of hope. I will take my leave one final time from the bedsides of the wounded and dying to meekly inherit whatever remains of that place I once loved, there where as of old, even in the valley of the shadow, I shall not want.
How did you navigate through those waters in that poem? It looks as if the stanza lines, the juxtaposition is where you get your power. It looks as if moving from stanza to stanza is the way you pilot your way. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true about you?
I do. I think that's mm-hmm. true.
And what does a person have to do to learn that?
I think basically you just have to trust yourself. Trust the voice inside your head that you don't necessarily speak in. There's another voice in there talking.
You talked about another parallel universe that writers, mostly poets, occupy. That's their true home. Mm-hmm. You write from that home. Mm-hmm. So what is the difference between imagination and reality?
For me, not much. I think, this is a weird thing that poets become poets because they're not so good at prose. They're not good at communicating in the language of the common vernacular. And that's because they see things differently than other people, I think. You say, oh, that's a tree. And I say, oh, no, that's a hemlock. And then a whole baggage of hemlock, including Socrates, comes with it,
And also, you have a bedrock of the Bible.
Right.
And a deep knowledge of the line in the mm-hmm. Bible. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the resonance is under that. I really wish you'd set up a Bible study course just for us poets who want to know what Isaiah really said behind the door, because you know all that. And how does that permeate your writing? I mean, is it just so much in your veins that it comes through?
I think so. I think it's like music in a musician's family. You've heard so much, you become deeply steeped in the stories of it. That poem that I just read, the reference to Egypt, I was thinking of Jacob and Joseph, Joseph in particular, how his brothers sold him because he was his father's favorite, mm-hmm. that many-colored coat. And he lived all of his life in Egypt, rose to become Pharaoh, but it wasn't home. He's there. He's certainly in it. In the valley of the shadow is a reference to Psalm 23. And, they're just there. They just rear their ugly heads. And I say, okay, come on in.
I think if you go to a bookstore and ask for Flying Out with a Wounded, is it NYU Press?
Yes, it is.
You will get it because it's in its seventh printing. And it's probably going to stay there with us forever. You have to say Ann Caston and the small bookstores don't usually keep all the books printed on their shelves, but they'll go get it if you say that. Flying out with a wound, and then you can be looking out for the second edition of a new book, and that is called what?
Judah's Lion.
That might be out this year, maybe 2009, so we'll be looking for that. Can you talk a little bit about the content of that book?
Yes. Judah's Lion deals more overtly with my work as a nurse again, but not... it's not the center of the book. The center of the book is really about my middle son, who was diagnosed borderline autistic, but who was very close to my heart because of the way he spoke and saw things. So this, because he was difficult to be in crowds, we spent a lot of time together, and he was a real joy to me. He was like living with another poet, with a visionary, with someone who could interpret dreams. He had an imaginary wildebeest. You know, he said, I would hear him singing. He would bump at night, and I would hear him singing down the hall. His phrase was, and I quoted in one of the poems, "Come in, ye wildebeest, come in, lie beside my bed. There are no lions here." And this is what he would say to himself, you know.
That is in Judah's Lion.
Yes, it
we
is.
Need that. We need that. Now, there's another book that I see half thrown around the room here, and that is called Empress of Longing. What is that book about?
That's the coming back to the woman in me, not putting aside being a nurse, but it's marginalizing that and really going deeper into a more personal vein of thoughts, feelings, emotions, histories.
I'm scared.
I am too.
And Kasten, here she is with a poem.
Okay. That imagination, of course, is good and bad. So I'm in this group of crazy women called the Chains, and every month we get this assignment, 10 words, and we have to put them in a poem. And it's been a real liberating experience for me because they're words I would not normally put in a poem. I have my favorite words. So you take these 10 words, and a poem arranges itself around it. And because I'm off guard and I'm not being too controlling, they come out. So this is what I wrote based on those words. This is called The Life I Might Have Had. Maybe it would be in a mining town, in an unpainted shack set deep in deciduous hills, someplace so removed and forgotten that only the rain comes to visit, like some awkward city cousin who, having arrived, is eager to leave again. Some place where even nature would set its green hand to obliterating the evidence of what happens or doesn't here. My man would work the mines, and as my people are wont to say, would be without. He'd have black dust in his hair, his nail beds, his lungs, and his back would be bent toward brokenness. Mm-hmm. Mine, too, from stooping over a house all day that's filthy with want. Mm-hmm. A house that's never wholly purged of anything. Spiders, mice, ice-rimed windows in winter. Despair. He'd not have drink, that man, for consolation, nor God, nor even his breath some days. He'd not have the luxury of even thoughts of suicide. Mm. What he'd have is his one dream, the damp, dark arc of the mine, and that gauzy silence of the moment before stone and timbers give way. I'd know his dream. He'd tell it to me, shuddering awake night after night. That's not the worst of it, he'd say, and he'd hesitate, a pool of gray sweat seeping into the sheet under him, the last threadbare sheet I'd take to the cold creek and scrub to tatters at first light. It ain't the cave-in I'm afeard of, or the dying, he'd say. It's the being buried and alive. And I would understand his terror, lying there next to him. I who'd have been there, too, each moon-bitten midnight, every tattered sock or deer-ravaged garden or rusted utensil pushing me further into it, the slow suffocation, the weight of it all bearing down, that being buried and alive.
There is so much poverty and richness mixed in some of the things you write, and in that poem also. Filled with want, a house filled with want. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a poet's house.
That's true.
For sure. Oh, can you pick out a couple of the words that were part of the 10 words you started with?
Oh, let's see if I can remember what they were.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I've just made the mind for
maybe
some
that's
reason.
Good, I think silence was one of them.
Silence was, you're right. Yeah.
And it's interesting because how they've been embedded, it would be almost as if you never had had 10 alien stones to start
really?
Working with, right?
Yeah.
Before we hear a final poem, you are a woman of great physical products. And that means you make quilts, you make soap, you make turtles, chocolate turtles, caramels. You cook, you sew, you make everything there is. When there's nothing, you make something anyway. Mm. Poetry among them. What's the difference with working with your hands and working with your mind?
Which one gets tired or faster? That's all. You know, if you do something with your hands physically, your mind is on poems or thinking. If you do something with your mind, then I find that my hands have to stay busy. So often I'm doing the two simultaneously.
Anne Caston, let's hear a final poem.
Final poem called I Used to Be Somebody's Daughter. This is my coming home poem. And now word comes your father ratchets day and night between the savage sleep of morphine and the ravaging cancer that drives through his body in the finest red carriage in town. Make way, make way. You are the clenched fist at the far Arctic edge of the world, unclenching into sorrow, into an old hard love for him that skitters in fits and starts like old film on a jittering reel. September's sycamores have surrendered their gold, but what is sufficient enough to ransom you home again now? You are still the snarled line, tangled twine, a lone signpost to hell, this way, this way. Water of undetermined depth and its warning, enter at your own risk. The pond is quieting now and rimed with ice. You could row all day over it and still end up right where you started, like a novel that closes and then the alarm clock went off. Same dull reminder that life is a story you tell yourself, but the story is not your life. The languid river of summer runs autumn slow tonight, and the slight amethyst of October's first light startles the horizon like a leper's bell in the market, and that good thief death will arrive. That much cannot be undone. The river's lesson tonight is the wanderer's lesson of passing through and returning home. Only the river is possible now. Real or imagined, it matters not, except that you get there soon. Invent the river. Invent the boat. Longing is the anchor lifting.
Anne Caston, why do we do this thing?
Poetry, you mean? Because it's the gift that was given to us. Or the burden.
Anne Caston, you will not forget her. Get her, read her, know her, and we will bring her back to you. This is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location. This program is produced by Forest Woods Media, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible and the Witter Binner Foundation for funding the series. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. I'm Grace Cavalieri.